Welcome to the show. This is Daniel Workman coming to you live from the Dreamaginate Sports Studios. It is 9 a.m. on the East Coast. This is your 6 a.m. West Coast wake-up call in all time zones in between and around the world. Welcome into the show. It's Tuesday, April 30th, and it's a big day today. Big day today because we kick off the semifinals of the UEFA Champions League, and it's not necessarily the match that some are anticipating, waiting for, which is tomorrow's match between my two favorite clubs, my all-time favorite Barcelona, and then my favorite Premier League club, Liverpool. But today is the match between Ajax and Tottenham, and it's going to be an interesting back and forth. Tottenham is a team that wants to play with the ball, and they attempt to play, you know, a version of positional play, juego de posición, a version of that. I would not say that they're full out, you know, Pep Guardiola esque, but they're definitely more in that mold of trying to keep possession and play with the ball as much as possible. And then you've got Ajax, which have basically reborn as Total Football again. Incredible young players, one of which is already Barcelona bound. There's another, their captain, who's also really young in De Ligt, that is rumored to be Barcelona bound. We can only, for those of us who are Barcelona supporters, can only hope that that is the case. But you have these two clubs that have kind of been overlooked coming into the semifinals. You have all the conversations surrounding, you know, Suarez and Coutinho, two former Liverpool players playing with Barcelona. And then, you know, obviously you have the greatest of all time, Messi, that's in playing for Barcelona in this match. I mean, you have that kind of story. But I think the Ajax and the Tottenham tie is definitely being overlooked. And I understand why. But I want to take a minute and kind of look at some things about Ajax specifically and celebrate some of the things that are going on. I've had the privilege of being in Holland and being at Ajax's training center and watching some of their youth teams train and play and kind of take in that environment. And then now to be able to kind of watch what, this team has been able to accomplish so far through the Champions League, through the group stages, knockout rounds, now into the semifinals. It's been a pleasure to watch, but one of the things that I think we miss, that we're overlooking in this Ajax club, is it's easy to kind of look beyond the realities of building that club. So that club is not built the same way that a Premier League club is built, meaning that in the Premier League, there's so much cash from TV and from commercial deals, etc., that clubs, even relegated clubs, are bringing in revenues beyond what Ajax has at their fingertips. So they have the executives at Ajax have been building this club from within. They have been developing players. They have been identifying players, bringing them into their club, developing, playing them young, molding the core of this group, and have been doing so without splashing major cash. Now they brought in, you know, a couple players here and there, but by and large, it's all been part of this youth movement. And in this youth movement, you're seeing some incredibly brave play, creative play, intelligent play, total football in many ways from players all over the field. De Jong, De Ligt, some others that are just moving the ball around positionally, doing some really, really great things. If you watched the matchup between Real Madrid and Ajax, you got to see at the Bernabeu just an incredible display of Ajax's team and team spirit and belief in their identity. And that's the big test. When you are a club and you go to, you know, you go on the road, you go into your opponent's, you know, home, backyard, stadium, whatever, however you want to look at it, and yet you have the belief and the courage to play your game despite the pressure, despite the fact that you're not at home, maybe you're not as comfortable, yet you're willing to do it, and not only willing but able to execute it. That was definitely a really, really, really amazing thing to see, and it's not something that you see that often, especially in the top levels of European football, that you see a club be brave enough to go on the road and still play the way that they want to play. Many times you see pragmatism, where you'll hear the terms parking the bus, and you'll hear other things like being conservative, sitting back, etc. And they're waiting to try to counter, or they're hoping to absorb pressure, etc. And yet Ajax came into the Bernabeu with the opposite mentality. We're going to play, and that is one of the elements of an independent club structure, in league structure and competition structure, that is so important. It's what we are missing in American soccer. By not having independent clubs be able to build their own identity, not be constrained by centralized control, a la MLS and Major League Soccer and their front office. MLS has the ability to veto player acquisitions, player transfers. There's all kinds of elements where Major League Soccer and Don Garber can basically tell you how to run your team and limit you in terms of what you can spend or where you can go to get your talent. I mean, there's all of these constraints. There's these, you know, I like to say, you know, they have their TAM, GAM, CAM, SPAM, whatever rules, right? That they're always putting in place these limitations where they're trying to create kind of an Americanized structure around the game of soccer, the game of football, the real global game of football. And it hurts us. It hurts us because if our top league is so controlled, if our top league has an inability to build independent, individual, innovative clubs and teams and talent and teams that are able to create their own unique identity based on, you know, maybe where they're from, based on, you know, who founded the club, etc. We miss stories like this. We miss stories like Ajax rising to the semifinals of the Champions League. Many are predicting that they're going to make it to the finals of the Champions League. And then you miss stories like Eibar in Spain, Bournemouth in England, these clubs that, you know, by any measure in America would never get a chance. They would never get an opportunity to play first division football in America. Ajax would have a chance, but the sad state of affairs in America is that even though Amsterdam, you know, is a city of a million plus, there are cities larger than Amsterdam in America that don't have first division soccer. And not only do they not have first division soccer, because of our system and our rules, they don't have a chance to have first division soccer unless they find someone to pay off the other major league soccer owners, i.e. the franchise fee, just to get in. That money is not going back into the game. It's not going back into developing soccer or building a club. That money is being paid out to the other owners to join their franchise system. It's a payout to the franchise owners. It doesn't go back to the players. It doesn't go back into the clubs. It goes into the owners' pockets. Those are elements that we're missing in terms of looking at what Ajax has done. They have gone out and they have found players. They have developed players. They have built an incredible group, this squad that has been capable of building all the way into the semifinals of the Champions League. And yet here in the U.S., that would not be possible. Ajax would not be permitted in our system without getting through the system of gatekeepers. And that's the element that we have to understand. It's why things have to change. It's why things need to be better. It's not about bashing Major League Soccer to bash Major League Soccer. It's not about being critical to be critical of the United States Soccer Federation. The point here is not that U.S. soccer and MLS are just the enemy and we just have to defeat them and destroy them and burn them to the ground. And I know there are a lot of people that want that. For me, that has never been the motivator for me. That has never been the way that I view our issues here in America. The way I view our issues here in the U.S. is that there are things we're doing that right now that are not beneficial for the game. And if we want to do things that are beneficial for the game, and if we want to essentially, you know, follow JFK's example and put a man on the moon, or in the case of American soccer, become the greatest soccer country on earth, then we need to change some of the things that we are doing. Those changes include governance with the federation. They include how we handle the treatment of independent clubs and giving them a bigger, better and stronger voice within the federation. But it also means that our system and structure of competition needs to change, that we need a connected system of leagues that literally turns the light on for access and opportunity to every community in this country. That's the real job of the federation. They get caught up doing other things. Their main priority should be ensuring that there is fair and equal access and opportunity to a connected system of leagues around the country. And that's not the business they're in. That's not the business they have been doing for years, for decades. They've never done that duty. And failing to do that duty has hurt American soccer. And so that's the piece that I look at. And that's it's not to say, hey, burn everything down. It's to say we can do better. We should be doing better. Everyone is going to benefit when we work together, when we are all connected into one system. We can better leverage our clubs, our teams across states, across cities, up and down the connected system of leagues, also known as a pyramid. And in doing that, everything improves: access to development, access to opportunity, access to play at the highest level now becomes a real thing for any kid in America. Now we have incentives for clubs to develop players, incentives for players to develop themselves. They want to reach the highest levels of the game, coaches, etc. I mean, it just, everything builds. And in watching what Ajax has done has really been great to see. And I hope that we take inspiration from Ajax as we learn and watch and see what they're doing through this season in the semifinals, and seeing what what they hopefully do today in terms of success with playing Tottenham here in the semifinals, and hopefully that inspires some change and progress within U.S. soccer. Today's sponsor is Charity Water. Charity Water provides clean drinking water to people all over the world. They are regularly providing access and opportunity to people to not only get clean drinking water, but it changes their lives. It gives them the opportunity to seek out education, betterment for their communities, etc. If you don't know about Charity Water, check them out at charitywater.org.
पहिला म पनि बच्चा अवस्थामा रहँदाखेरि मैले यो कल्पना गरेको थिएन कि तर अहिलेको बच्चाहरूलाई मैले सोद्धाखेरि अथवा उनीहरूको क्लासमा गएर तिमी के भन्ने भनेर भन्दाखेरि उनीहरू बच्चाहरूले एक क्लास दुई क्लास तिन क्लासका बच्चाहरूले उनीहरूले सहजै रूपमा चाहिँ प्रयुक्त गर्न सक्छन्।
म टिचर बन्छु,
सोसल वर्कर, इन्जिनियर।
Welcome back to the show. Joining us now is Dave Larriba, the executive director of West Virginia Soccer Association. Dave, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. You know, that's West by God, Virginia, Dan.
West by God, Virginia Soccer Association. I miss those initials in looking everything up and researching for the show. So I'll make sure I go back and look those up and make sure those get included from now on.
That's good.
So Dave, tell us, you've been involved in soccer and in West Virginia soccer for a long time. Tell us a little bit how did you get started? What kind of started your interest and desire to kind of get involved and work within the game?
Well, basically, I grew up in Manchester, New Hampshire, in high school in the late 60s, early 70s. Soccer was just coming around, and there was a little bit of club soccer, but soccer really wasn't a big sport in most of that area. I moved to West Virginia to go to college, and West Virginia Wesleyan had good college soccer, and in the kind of devil's triangle of West Virginia Wesleyan, Davis and Elkins, and Allison Broadus, there was some good small college soccer, so I got to watch that. Then, get married, move to a different part of the state, have some kids, and my oldest son came home. He was 8 with a little piece of paper that was probably an inch wide and a page length wide that said soccer signups for the Y soccer Saturday at whatever. And he said, "Can I go?" Well, I wish I would have said no because it started an odyssey. This was in the very early 80s, and so he went and signed up. And just like a lot of people that are involved in the grassroots level, I hadn't had a lot of any experience really in soccer, but they needed some help. They needed coaches, and a couple of us, just like a lot of parents do, maybe said, "Hey, you know, our team isn't getting the kind of help it should get, and what's going on?" And they said, "Yeah, you know, you're right. So you two guys are now in charge," and it was, you know, basically telling us put up or shut up. So we left the Y, went to the library, took out every book on soccer, which was three of them, and got the old Coca-Cola reel-to-reel Pele movie on soccer. And that's how we started. And there's a lot of people in this country that started that way out, you know, not in the big cities and where there was a lot of soccer going on. And it just kind of evolved. I went through licensing. I ended up getting a D license. And this is before I gained, you know, a couple hundred pounds, and just started getting along. And then I, you know, again, with the state association, I was representing the local association and had some questions, had some concerns. Next thing you know, I'm in charge of something. And it just started in the early mid 80s, and it evolved to being an officer of the board, being president. And then after my term of president in 1994, becoming the first executive director. And the rest, I guess, is history.
So you get involved and you work your way from the grassroots into state level kind of leadership, and then to running the state, and then now serving as the executive director since 1994. Take us back to the 80s. What was soccer like in West Virginia in terms of organizationally? Was there a strong association? Was it kind of still really green and you guys were just figuring it out? Like, what was the landscape like there in the 80s?
The landscape in the 80s was soccer in West Virginia was new. There were a few pockets in the Charleston area, in the Morgantown area, that had hospitals and that had industries that would maybe bring people from other countries, other cultures into the state that had a lifelong history of soccer. And so soccer started to spread. As I said before, there was some really good small college soccer in West Virginia. And so there was a kind of a background there. But then soccer just, you know, started taking hold in the small communities, you know, and again, this was a rural state. You know, it's a big American football and a big basketball state. Those are the sports that are king. And so you have that problem of, hey, you're trying to bring a communist sport into this God-fearing state of West Virginia. And so you have to fight those battles. But just by perseverance and education, that was overcome. There wasn't a lot of competitive soccer at that time. There wasn't high school soccer. So by the late 80s, then there started to be some decent competitive soccer, started putting teams in the regional competitions, and then high school soccer started at the club level, and then it evolved in the very late 80s into actually a sanctioned sport in West Virginia, which a lot of people said was going to be the death of sports in the state of West Virginia. Didn't work out that way. And so we also had, there was an adult, a smaller adult group. And again, not 100%, but a large majority of those were people that were from other countries that had grown up with the soccer heritage, that were here in the state for jobs or for education. And so those again, Morgantown, Charleston were the two pockets. But with a small state, you don't really have enough people to have two associations governing the sport. And there was conflicts and things going on. And so a bunch of us got together and said, look, why don't we just have a joint association? There weren't very many of them then at that time. There was North Texas, I'm not sure if Pennsylvania West was a joint state then. There were very few. And so we talked to some people and we got together and it was, look, we want to make sure that the adults have autonomy to run their affairs and elect their officers. And we want the youth to do the same, but we want to have a common focus, you know, with coaching and referee development and those kind of things and relationships with the Federation. So we, in 1987, we merged the two associations together and started the West Virginia Soccer Association. And that was really when we started kind of moving together because everybody in the state was working on the same page, the same level.
So take us, kind of pick up at that timeline. You were around at that point, being involved with U.S. soccer as well, working within West Virginia soccer, correct?
Yes, I attended my first AGM at the Federation in 1984.
So when you were around U.S. soccer back then, this is obviously pre-World Cup, pre-Major League Soccer, and that's around the time that you're looking at, you know, the World Cup being awarded to the U.S. What was that like in terms of being around those conversations, hearing that, you know, because we're leading up to 2026. We know that we're getting 2026 after missing out on 18 and 22. What were some of the conversations like back then in terms of looking at, hey, could we maybe eventually host a World Cup?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because, you know, and I listened to the first part of your show today, and, you know, the way things are today and the way we wish things would be different, you go back into the 80s and there was nothing. There was basically the NASL had folded. There was no really pro soccer to really say much about. You had the youth association, you had the adult association. There at that time, you know, there wasn't U.S. Club. AYSO was there, but they weren't. They hadn't, you know, come up on the national stage the way they did in the 90s. You know, that was basically it. There was no pro council. There was no youth athlete council. You know, it was the adults and the youth basically, and those were the votes. And it was kind of different. And you had some people, Warner Stricker was president, and you had some people that had some vision about creating a national program and for the World Cup. And back then, you know, some of the people like Sunil Gulati was one of those people, a very young Sunil Gulati, Richard Groff, Kevin Payne, and tons of other people. And just started promoting games, trying to get some interest in the sport and in the national team, and then hey, you know, so that was tough. A lot of people really didn't care. A lot of people that were here from other countries, they cared about England, they cared about Germany, they cared about France, they cared about Brazil. The U.S. national team didn't mean anything to them, and so that was a process that basically took, you know, some work getting together. And then the idea was, let's try for the World Cup. And people were, you know, crazy. We're never going to give the World Cup to the U.S. But some of the people at FIFA and Werner Fricker and others in the United States saw the market, saw the potential of soccer in the United States and also the commercial end of it, which was not a small part of that, and you know, decided to support the bid. The bid was put together, and you know, it was a huge celebration when we were awarded the bid.
Now, being around U.S. soccer as long as you have, I know that you have so many stories. You've seen a lot. You've heard a lot. Tell us one of the craziest stories that you've ever seen in terms of FIFA or elections or you know, envelopes of cash. There's all of these, you know, rumors out there, and people have heard, like, hey, whispers of, hey, you know, these were some crazy times back in the day with this, that, or the other, with FIFA or with other things. What's one of the craziest things you've seen in being around the game back at that point?
Well, I guess the craziest time was, you know, after we had the World Cup bid and we were coming up for the elections in, I guess, 92, and Werner Fricker was running, and a guy by the name of Paul Steele from Maryland was running against Werner, but it was pretty much assumed that Werner was gonna win, and all of a sudden you start hearing these rumors that FIFA was unhappy with the leadership, and they were gonna put supported a candidate. So, you know, you're looking at all the usual suspects, and they're like, no, we're not running. And so all of a sudden, somebody who had been very instrumental in the LA Olympics, Alan Rothenberg, was put forward as a candidate. Well, most of us had never had any interactions or knew Alan at all, but he was supported by FIFA. And, you know, Daniel, as you know, we talked back in Philadelphia with at the workshop at NCAA a year ago, talking about the election and how it was crazy and all this, everything being said and all these, you know, dirty tricks, whatever. I'm telling you, as I told you back then, it had nothing, didn't hold a candle to what happened back at that time. And there was pressures being put again. The youth and adult votes meant a lot more back then because there was no pro council, there was no athlete council. So they were, every state association in the youth and the adult meant a lot as far as votes were concerned. And I'm not saying they were threats, but because in West Virginia, obviously we didn't have big cities, we weren't hosting international games. And at that time, the host state association made a lot more money off hosting international games than they do now. So there was some incentives for states that wanted to host international games and get some of that money to make sure the people that were in charge were happy with them. Let's put it that way.
Fair enough. And we can use our imaginations to go from there when we look at incentives. So I want to keep walking through the timeline for a minute, because you have such a vast and expansive history working within U.S. soccer for decades. We come into the 90s and we're heading into the World Cup. What was the... You know, for the kids now who are looking at, oh, we're going to get to host the World Cup in 2026. What was the environment like in building up to 94 in the early 90s in terms of within the soccer community, in the soccer space, the state associations? You know, what was the conversation like? What was the mood like? You know, what was everyone expecting or hoping for with the 94 World Cup?
Well, people were hoping that it would lead to an explosion in the interest in soccer in the country and the support for soccer from corporations and other entities. And what the Federation did, and I think they're going to do similar things this time around, but they reached out to all the organizations. Again, at that time, you know, it was just the state associations pretty much. Now it's going to involve, you know, U.S. Club and AYSO and all the various organizations. USSSA and whatever. But they reached out, and there were liaisons in all the various areas, and they would reach out to the states in their area and say, you know, hey, we need your help promoting this. We have some deals for tickets, we, you know, different things. And there was a real effort put out to promote the World Cup to the local communities, especially in areas that wouldn't be hosting games but would have an interest and maybe be able to drive to a game, in a 2 or 3 hour time frame. So that worked out well. There were, you know, we sold a lot of tickets in West Virginia, and most of the people went to D.C. from West Virginia to see games. But we had people that had friends. I mean, my family and I went to Detroit to see games. We had people all over the country going to see games, depending on their vacation time and whatever. But and that happened in other states. It happened around and got the interest up. And but everybody bought in. You know, the adult association, the state, the youth associations, the joint associations, everybody bought in to let's promote this and it be good things. And at the same time, in the run-up, you had the women's winning the first World Cup for women. And so you had the start of the women having some attention and getting some notice. And so you had, not only did you have the men's World Cup coming, but you had the women being world champion. And so then you had, all of a sudden, you had a bunch of girls that, hey, wow, girls are people. Girls can play soccer too. Because in a lot of the country, there wasn't a lot of girls soccer. And West Virginia was one of those places. And after the 91 World Cup, girls soccer exploded in a lot of the country. And West Virginia was one of those places.
So we get towards the end of the 90s. Major League Soccer has come in instead of the famous, sometimes mythical Warner Fricker plan of promotion and relegation. Sunil Gulati had actually, way back when, had worked on a plan, or maybe it was part of Fricker's plan to have promotion and relegation. We get into a world where Major League Soccer exists. It's struggling at the end of the 90s, going into the early 2000s. And U.S. soccer undergoes what I would classify as a major governance restructure in terms of some of the councils and the way that the voting and representation works today were changed at that point. Why did that happen? And what were the conversations surrounding that movement to make those changes away from what you were talking about in terms of the adults and youth were the lion's share of voting versus now, where we've got multiple councils and fractures, segmentation within those councils?
Well, Daniel, I don't think we have enough time to go into that history from 1998. But real, basically what happened was when MLS got going, and for various reasons, the model that was taken at the time was what people felt needed to happen in order to get people to invest the money. There were, you know, still franchises folding, and you had some of the big and NFL families like Hutz and others and Crafts that put money into the sport using their NFL stadiums to try to create something. And again, they felt this is the structure we had to have in order to control that, so it didn't go off the rails like NASL had gone off the rails. People just spending and killing the competition in the sport. So that happened back then. And then there was a complaint, and it was actually filed by AYSO, that the governance wasn't fair because those that had the most people had the most votes. And so the USOC, who oversees the federation because of the national governing body status, came in and basically said, you got to fix this. You got to have one person, one vote. You got to work it out. Your athletes have to have 20% of vote in everything that has to do with the actual sport. Every committee, every group has to have 20% athlete representation. And that's the way it is. You got to do this, or we're going to just decertify the federation. And that was serious. It was big. It was serious. And so what was developed was a structure of the youth, adult, and pro councils, each ending up with the same number of votes. The youth were going to have the most people, so there had to be multipliers. To the adults would have the next amount. They would have a multiplier that would give them the same votes as the youth. The pros at that time had 5 or 6 people. I mean, was real small back then, and they had to have the same multiplier. Then you had the 20% athletes, which originally was thought the 20% of athletes were going to be part of each council. But then the USOC said, no, can't do it that way. The athletes have to have their own. And that kind of tipped things a little bit. But so we ended up with the athlete council with 20%, and then the other three councils with equal percentages, plus the board of directors and, you know, the group of other people added in there. And it was contentious. It was ugly. There was a lot of shouting and yelling and things said and bad blood. But at the end, it was really one of those things is, if we want to still be a member of the USOC, we have to do this. And so I think for a lot of people, begrudgingly voted for the plan the way it was at that time. You know, things have evolved. I think none of us, at least I didn't, foresee the way the kind of political landscape would be now with the athletes and the pros kind of having control over a lot of what goes on. That was something that I didn't see, and I don't think a lot of other people saw it. It evolved. Didn't happen right away. It happened, you know, that was in 1998, so it's been a long time for that to happen. But I think we saw that pretty evident in the election of 2018.
Yeah, I mean, look, we saw it in the election in 2018. There's no doubt about it. I saw it again this year. At this year's AGM with some of the policy proposals and, you know, some things that were not voted in, and it was clear that there was an alliance, a block, voting block, between the pro council and athlete council. So basically it was kind of like, hey, if we don't like something, we're just going to work together. We'll knock that out. And, you know, so, you know, I think that's been playing out, not just last year, but I think it's played out before. And obviously, I think played out again this year. I want to, you know, spend a few minutes here talking about West Virginia soccer today and some of the opportunities and the challenges that you guys have there in the state of West Virginia, or as you corrected me, West by God, Virginia. So give us a little bit of insight. What is, if you're a young boy or a young girl growing up in West Virginia, what is the opportunities? What are the pathways for a player in your state to grow up, to play the game, and then try to rise to, you know, to develop as a player?
Well, there's a lot more opportunities like now than when my two boys were starting in the 80s, because we have a lot more clubs. We have some pretty big clubs that play a pretty good level of soccer around the region. We have some grassroots programs that are really trying to grow the game, get people interested, educate coaches. One of those is is the Convoy Soccer League that your friend and mine, Chris Kessel, is the president of, and they're doing a lot of things. We try to encourage people to get involved. I mean, one of the different things about West Virginia, and you know, Chris Kessel is an example. You know, 2 years ago, I said, "Hey, how can I get involved?" And I said, "Well, you know, come along, get interested, run for an office, get on the board," and he did. And he became president of his league, became a member of our state board. He's been, you know, not in every state can someone do that. We're always looking for people and new ideas. So I think that's kind of thing. We have players now that are playing in development academies in Philadelphia and in Columbus. We have some girls playing, I think, in Minnesota. You know, so the options are there. We're having players that are getting recognized at the regional level, and we've had, I don't know how many kids take European trips in the last few years with the region. We've started, again, West Virginia, taking our Olympic development teams overseas, went to Scotland last year, went to Italy this year with the boys and the girls. So those things are there. We have college soccer has continued to grow in this state. Just I think all the small colleges in the state now have soccer programs. The you know, Marshall University and Western University, the two Division I schools. So we have opportunities for people to play and to get better. The struggle is we still don't have a large enough number of people who played soccer as a kid who grew up in the sport to be coaches, because number one, a lot of our population moves away for jobs and other reasons. We still get an influx of people from other countries coming in that bring soccer with them, but we still have to educate a lot of parents who are like I was in 1981 that this is a soccer ball. And you kick it, and it goes over there, and it's a goal if it goes inside the post. We have to educate those folks, and it's hard. And so we that's where we need help. Our association tries to support the local clubs and leagues. One of the things that I think you know I'm not happy about with the federation is with the new grassroots coaching courses. The federation is charging $25 for everybody to take a course to them, and with the advanced the professional coaches, the people that are making money coaching, I don't worry about that. But in our state, we still have a large majority of what I call mom and pop coaches who are coaching because their little Johnny or little Susie's team needs a coach, and if they want their child to play soccer, they're going to have to step up. So their first question is, okay, but I don't know anything. What do I do? And if we want them to go through the federation courses, okay, you got to pay $25 to the federation to take this course, and then it's going to cost you $15, $25 for the state because you know, we have to pay for the coach, the instructor, and we have to get the facility, and there are costs to that. So what we've decided to do after trying with the federation for a year or so to get some mediation on that, which they won't do, our membership decided at our AGM back in March that we would subsidize the local state costs of recreation level, grassroots level coaches taking the federation grassroots courses. That was unanimously approved by our membership. It's going to cost us some money, but they also voted for a fee increase. And, you know, that's something that I think in our state, if people know that we need that, and if we can't get the help we need from someplace else, then we're going to have to step up and do it ourselves.
So educating coaches and parent education is a big thing for American soccer. There are pockets, there are large pockets of what I would classify as soccer-first culture within the country, but there are large swaths of the country, places like what you're describing there in West, by God, Virginia, that, you know, that still need to connect the dots, you know, on a foundational level, fundamental level, for the game. And you see that, you know, I was having a conversation a couple of days ago, with a parent who was talking about their son in playing. He had played kind of a grassroots level, recreational type level play, and this was his first season playing, you know, in a club soccer environment, and she was commenting about the difference in the coaching. And I was like, well, that's what you're paying for. What my experience has been is that for every kind of, you know, set up where you let's say you've got eight teams playing in a rec league or a, you know, a local league, you might have one or two parents that understand the game and know the game and can do, you know, at least on a minimum level, a decent job of communicating that and teaching the game to those kids. But then you'll have six other parents who the first time that they've seen a soccer game was the game that they coached. And so that big discrepancy between having, you know, one or two that could know the game, teach the game, versus the parents who were filling a need and wanted to help but didn't really know what to do to help, it was probably why this parent had felt a little bit of frustration, you know, with the kind of environment. And so I think what you're doing there in West Virginia is so important in terms of providing more access and opportunity to education and parent education, coaching education, et cetera. When you guys are looking at West Virginia from a state level and you're looking at the adults, you're looking at the youth, the whole gamut, what is the dream? What are you trying to build? What is the goal as you lead as the executive director of West Virginia Soccer? What are you trying to accomplish in your position there with West Virginia Soccer?
Well, let me also just say that our state president, Len Rogers, we're 100% together on doing these things, and he has the vision. You know, we've hosted Eastern Regional President's Cup and National Championship Series several times and are doing it again this year and next year. You know, bringing soccer, bringing the awareness of what's going on in the region to our area, getting more government and corporate support for the sport in the state. So what we'd like to do is, you know, we want to have a situation where all our coaches have a federation license that are coaching in the competitive travel, whatever you want to call it, club soccer area. You know, we'd like to have a D license for everybody. We're getting that way, but we have room to go. We want all our coaches at the grassroots level to have some type of coaching education, whether it's the federation pathway or whether it's just a clinic to learn the basics of soccer, which we also provide for our members. And it's covered by their membership fees. We don't charge for those kind of courses, just like a couple hours, you know, on a Saturday morning, come out and we'll have one of our instructors teach the under six folks, this is what you should be doing, that kind of thing. We want that statewide. It's happening in some of the larger areas, but we've got to get it out into the hills and the hinterlands, where, you know, you've got to have people have to drive an hour and a half or 2 hours for their under 12 kids just to play another recreation game, you know, because that's every kid that wants to play soccer in that community is playing. And so it's small communities. So we hope to make that happen and just to keep giving our kids the opportunities to try to help advance the total sport on the adult level, to get more people playing, to take parents, convert them into players, so then they have a more interest in the game. And we have one USL team in the state in Charleston. We'd like to have more of that going on. And so people can see, hey, you know, we've got high school, we've got college, we have semi-pro, pro, you know, here's what soccer can be for you for the rest of your life.
I think that is so good. You know, when I've had conversations with people within the game, people on the same level as you working, you know, at a state level, you know, you get kind of a roundabout like, well, we'd like to make soccer better. We'd like to, but the fact that you've got an idea, you can tell that you guys are working down, you know, an objective and a goal. And that goal is so important, because at that level, that grassroots level, up into, you know, some of the travel and competitive that you were referring to, having better educated leaders, coaches, parents, will eventually lead to better development for players, better environments for players, even for the parents themselves. So I think that you can tell that, you know, having a clear idea of what you want to do and how you want to go about doing it is so critical. And so I think that is great. One of the things I've been doing is, as we kind of wrap up here with guests recently, is that I asked them, and I'm going to ask you this same type of question. If you were president or the czar, the king of American soccer for a day, and you could do anything to change or reform, amend, you know, whatever, you have absolute authority for one day, what would you do while you were in charge?
You know, I think you asked me a similar question at the AGM this winter, and I think my answer was I would create a time machine, go back 30 years, blow everything up, and start over again. And you know, if there's a way, and if I knew it, I would be pushing it now, but there's gotta be some way that we can get on the right track. We've got the youth fighting each other. We've got, somewhat in the adults. We've got, you know, youth and adults versus pros and athletes. That's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. We have to get ourselves together to promote the sport in the United States, not just our sport, not just West Virginia, not just youth, not just adults, not just, you know, MLS, whatever. And I would try to get some heads together. And I know Pro Rel with MLS is going to be one of the hardest things to happen without outside mandates. But there's got to be some way we can get the brighter lights of soccer, and maybe from outside soccer in this country, together in a room and lock the door and say, you got to fix this stuff. I just had to catch myself. And you know, we're not going to let you out till you fix it. I don't know the answer, Daniel. I don't. I mean, I don't, and I don't know anyone that does know the answer, that because it's not easy. We know where we'd like it to be. But how do we get from where we've allowed it to go to where it should be? That's the problem. We got to fix the youth landscape. But with the billions of dollars that's being put out there in the youth game, how do we do that? There's no easy answer. The answers are hard, and we have to all understand we need to make the hard choices. It's probably not what you wanted to hear, but that's
That's great, because I think a lot of people who follow the game in terms of some of the behind the scenes of American soccer, not just surface level, you know, are always curious about, you know, well, why don't things change? And they are. They're very hard. There are a lot of things that are baked in. And, you know, I wish that, you know, just like asking that question, you could just snap your fingers and go in a time machine and head back 30 years and blow it all up and start over. I wish it were that easy. And you know, you and I both know it's not. And so kind of figuring that out, working through that is definitely a challenge, but I think it's a worthwhile cause. And I know that, like Chris in your state, Chris Kessel, a friend of mine and friend of yours, you know, that there are others like him that are constantly trying to figure out ways to make it better locally where they are and also better on a national level as well. So hopefully there will be more and more people that wake up to that reality of your answer and join in working to figure out solutions. And I think that's probably what needs to happen next, is that more people need to start joining that conversation and coming together to figure out a way to make things better for their local area, but also the country at large. Dave, thanks for joining us on the show. People can connect with you on Twitter at SEDAWG40 on Twitter, and also can find you through the West Virginia Soccer Association's website. Again, it's been a real pleasure having you on the show. Thanks for joining us, and we look forward to having you back on again soon.
Thanks. To get back again, I'll tell you the USA men's versus Ajax story from back in the day.
Well, I look forward to having you back on to do that and doing that soon. Thanks for joining us.
Okay, thank you, Dan.
That was Dave Laraba joining the show. Just a little tribute music here for him. He is a great storyteller, and we could have spent all day just kind of going through the time machine, having conversations and talking all kinds of things. But he is a good guy, really good guy. Met him through the election last year, working with Eric Winalda, and he's working hard to try to make soccer better there in West Virginia. And it's really good to have him on the show, and I look forward to having him back on. We'll get more stories and more insight from him. So it's always a pleasure talking with Dave. He's a riot. So thanks for joining the show today. Thanks for tuning in each and every weekday at 9 a.m. Eastern. Tomorrow we have the pleasure of being joined by Tommy Muller Nielsen from he's Danish, and he's a scout for Manchester United, and I really look forward to having him on to kind of talk about what he's seeing in the game in Europe and the kind of players that they're looking to bring into a team like Manchester United, and kind of his background and all that. So I think it's going to be fascinating. And so anyway, tune in tomorrow at 9 a.m. Eastern. You can watch, always listen on danielworkman.com. Thanks for joining us. We will see you tomorrow.